if you've ever felt like, quantum physics just sounds like this random, unpredictable chaos.
Right, like totally incomprehensible.
Yeah, exactly. But what if that specific assumption is exactly what's holding all of our modern technology back?
It's a huge question.
Today, we are doing a deep dive into a really radical, paradigm-shifting theory. And it attempts to completely upend how we think about quantum computing, physics, and really the very fabric of reality itself.
Ambitious stuff.
Very. We're pulling from a fascinating set of sources today for you. We've got some deeply conceptual notes on something called metafunctional space, along with a presentation transcript by Praveer Malik. And that one is titled Enhancing Feynman's Quantum Computational Positioning.
Right.
Our mission for this deep dive is to figure out if the universe is actually just this casino of rolling dice, or if something much more structured is running the show. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, to truly grasp what this new theory is proposing, we really have to start by examining the giant it is trying to topple. And that giant is Richard Feynman. If you follow the history of technology at all, you know his name. I mean, he is essentially the godfather of the current quantum computing industry.
Absolutely.
But to understand why our current computers are built the way they are right now, we have to look at Feynman's fundamental philosophy of nature.
And his philosophy was heavily rooted in the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, right?
Yes.
Which is essentially the orthodox textbook view that gets taught in universities today.
That's exactly correct. The Copenhagen interpretation essentially argues that nature, at least at the microscopic subatomic level, is fundamentally unknowable and probabilistic.
Okay.
Under this view, until you actually measure a quantum object, it doesn't have a fixed state. It just exists in this blurry cloud of pure probability.
Right.
It is only the act of measuring it that actually forces it to collapse into a definitive readable state.
So, wait, let me make sure I'm tracking the logic here.
Yeah.
Because we, as observers, can only ever see the final collapsed measurement, Feynman basically concluded that the hidden machinery of the universe itself must be inherently random.
That was his conclusion, yeah. By definition, under the orthodox view, we can never peek behind the curtain to see some deterministic gear turning.
Let me just get the math.
Right, all we get are statistical probabilities. So Feynman's logic for building a quantum computer naturally followed that exact same path.
Makes sense.
If you want a machine to simulate the fundamental behavior of nature, and you genuinely believe nature is inherently unpredictable and probabilistic,
Then your computer has to be probabilistic too.
exactly.
The sources quote Feynman directly on this, actually. He basically said that to predict a probabilistic system, you have to, quote, repeat the experiment in nature by a large number of times.
Right.
You essentially just brute force the calculation by running the statistics over and over to mimic that quantum randomness.
Yes. And that statistical probability-driven blueprint is the absolute foundation for the billions of dollars currently being poured into quantum hardware today.
Which brings us to the core conflict of our sources, because Praveer Malik looks at that foundational assumption, the idea that the universe is just this giant game of chance, and he pushes back hard.
He really does. He points out what he sees as a massive, glaring logical flaw in Feynman's basic premise.
Oh, yeah.
Malik argues that if nature were truly just random, rolling dice at the quantum sub-basement level, the intricate, highly ordered structures we see everywhere around us couldn't possibly sustain themselves.
That actually raises a really visceral question for me, honestly.
Horribly.
Well, if the foundation of a house is made of constantly rolling dice, how does the house stay standing for billions of years without collapsing?
Right.
I mean, if the fundamental substrate of reality is pure, unpredictable chaos, you'd think a random quantum impulse would constantly destabilize the matter built on top of it.
You would.
How would DNA reliably replicate? Or how would a cell even maintain its structure?
You've hit the exact nail on the head. If the bottom layer is pure statistical noise, the macro layers shouldn't logically be capable of the immense stable complexity we observe in biological life.
Right.
Or even something as basic as the rigid architecture of the periodic table, Because of this, Malik argues that probabilistic quantum computers are a dead end.
A dead end. Wow.
Yeah, he says they will never truly crack the code of imitating nature because nature isn't just some murky casino.
So, okay, if we toss out the dice, what replaces them? If the universe isn't built on probability, what is the alternative foundation that Malik is proposing here?
This is where we make a total shift in perspective. So Malik introduces an alternative called the quantum computational model of light.
Light, okay.
Yeah. Instead of starting with physical particles bumping into each other, this model suggests reality is projected by light. But we have to picture light differently here.
Oh, so?
Well, not just as a photon traveling from the sun to the Earth, but as existing in different conceptual layers. In its native, ultimate state, Malik's model imagines light traveling infinitely fast.
Wait, let me wrap my head around that. Infinitely fast. We're not talking about the cosmic speed limit we all know, like the 186,000 miles per second?
No. We are talking about true mathematical infinity.
Okay, because if something moves at infinite speed, it essentially abolishes the concept of distance entirely, doesn't it?
What's fascinating here is that when you strip away the cosmic speed limit and imagine light at infinite speed, it fundamentally yields four distinct absolute properties.
Oh, I see.
Let's look at the first one, which addresses your exact point about distance. That property is presence.
Presence.
Right. Because this light takes absolutely zero time to get from point A to point B, it is immediately present everywhere within a given volume at the exact same time.
It doesn't travel. It just is.
Precisely. It just is. Now, the second property is power.
Power.
Because it is everywhere instantaneously, it possesses an absolute omnipresence that would fundamentally overpower or encompass anything that is not of the nature of light.
That makes sense.
And the third property is knowledge.
Wait. How does infinite speed equate to knowledge?
Well, think about what it means to be everywhere simultaneously.
Right.
If this light occupies every single point in a volume at once, it intrinsically records and contains the appearance, the state, and the potential of all things within that space.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It possesses total instantaneous knowledge of its domain because there is literally no gap in its presence.
That's wild. Okay. And the fourth.
Finally, the fourth property is harmony. Since everything within this infinite light is implicitly connected without any separation or delay, a perfect, unbroken harmony exists across the entire system.
Okay, so we've got presence, power, knowledge, and harmony. But obviously, you and I don't live in a universe of infinitely fast light.
Right, we don't.
When I look around the room, I see discrete objects. See, a universe where light has a very strict speed limit.
And that brings us to the crucial mechanism of what he calls quantization.
Quantization.
Yes. In this framework, material reality is what happens when that infinite light slows down. It projects itself at a speed less than infinity.
Oh, I see.
And when it hits that speed limit, those four absolute unified properties we talked about, presence, power, knowledge, and harmony, they can no longer remain absolute.
Because the speed is limited now.
Exactly. So they have to differentiate, they objectify and break apart into an infinite set of combinations.
I think an analogy might help ground this for you listening. Picture a vintage movie projector, right?
It's a good way to look at it.
If you spin the reel of film infinitely fast, the human eye can't process any individual images. All you see on the wall is just a pure blinding white screen.
Right.
That's our infinite light. It's pure unified presence, power, knowledge, and harmony. But as the projector slows down, the white screen starts to flicker. And as it slows even more, suddenly you can perceive individual differentiated frames. Material reality finally appears on the screen, but only because the light slowed down enough to allow distinct objects to form.
That projector analogy captures the mechanism perfectly, actually. As the light in Malik's model slows down to, the speed of light in our physical universe,
yeah,
we get the emergence of the physical world.
But I do want to push on that mechanism a bit.
Sure.
Because if material reality is just slowed down light, how do we get the actual physical rules of our universe from those super abstract concepts?
Fair question.
Like, how do things like space, time, energy, and gravity literally materialize from, knowledge and power?
Well, they don't just appear out of nowhere. They are direct structural translations of those four original properties of light into a slower physical layer.
Okay.
Let's trace the logic together. In Malik's model, the pre-material layers of light generate an infinite number of unique potentials, or what he calls seeds.
Seeds. Got it.
If you have all this latent knowledge, all these seeds of potential, how do you express them physically?
Well, you would need a place to put them, right?
Exactly.
You can't express a potential without a canvas to paint it on.
Yeah.
So knowledge requires an arena.
Yes. And space is that physical arena.
Ah.
When light slows down, space emerges as the physical vehicle for the original property of knowledge. And this has a profound implication.
What's that?
It means space is fundamentally granular. It's not this smooth, continuous, empty void we normally think of.
Right.
It is made of discrete points, because it exists specifically to house these infinite, distinct seeds of potential.
Okay, so if space is the physical translation of knowledge, what translates into time?
Think about the original property of power.
Okay.
Power is the unstoppable drive of these pre-material seeds to mature and express themselves in reality, regardless of physical obstacles.
Right, it's the drive.
So time isn't just some universal ticking clock humming in the background. Time captures the varying rates at which these different seeds mature. Therefore, time is the physical vehicle for power.
Okay, that leaves presence and harmony. Let me guess the logic here.
Go for it.
If presence means being everywhere and occupying reality, the physical translation of that would be the actual substance filling the universe, right?
Yes.
So energy is the process of those subtle seeds becoming concrete. Energy is the vehicle for presence.
You've got it. Which just leaves gravity.
Right.
If harmony is the implicit, unbroken connection between all things in the infinite state, then gravity is the physical vehicle for harmony.
Wow.
It is the literal relationship and attraction pulling all these different granular seeds together in physical space.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The notes we have on metafunctional space take this idea of granularity even further.
They do.
They say that because space is granular, you know, made of infinite unique seeds, every single discrete point of space is actively governed by its own specific presiding metafunction.
That is a very critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
A metafunction is essentially a precise logic, a set of hidden instructions operating from that pre-material layer of light.
Okay.
It means a volume of space isn't just a passive background reality. It's an active, emergent property constantly being driven and maintained by these underlying metafunctions.
So we really have to completely abandon the idea of space as an empty cardboard box that we just happen to place planets and stars inside of.
Exactly.
It's much more like a highly programmed digital pixel grid. And every single pixel on that grid has its own unique set of instructions.
Yeah.
Its metafunction telling it exactly how to behave.
That is exactly the paradigm shift Malik is proposing here. And honestly, it has massive implications for how we compute reality.
I bet.
If you want to simulate space, you can't just acknowledge that it's a grid of pixels. You have to actually understand and account for the specific operative metafunctions dictating the behavior at every precise point.
Which completely blows Feynman's, you know, let's just roll the dice and see what happens, statistically approach right out of the water.
Absolutely.
If there is a hidden logic driving every pixel, probability is just the wrong tool for the job.
It is entirely the wrong tool. And if you accept this premise, that space and time are emergent properties of slowing light, governed by highly specific metafunctions, then the bedrock mathematical equations of modern physics have to be completely reinterpreted.
Oh, wow.
Malik argues these equations aren't describing a random probabilistic universe at all. They are describing a highly structured process of materialization.
So the presentation we are looking at specifically tackles three of the most famous mathematical concepts in physics.
Right.
Schrödinger, Heisenberg, and Euler. Let's start with Schrödinger's wave equation, which is basically the holy text of quantum probability. How does this light matrix change your understanding of it?
Well, in Schrödinger's equation, you have the imaginary number I. Traditionally, it's just a mathematical tool to make the probability waves calculate correctly. But in Malik's non-probabilistic interpretation, it represents a literal mechanism.
A mechanism for what?
It's the actual dynamic interplay between our physical dimension and the antecedent pre-material dimensions of light. The equation also relies heavily on Planck's constant, right?
Right, which is usually taught as the smallest possible measurement in quantum mechanics.
Right, but Malik's model interprets Planck's constant as an inverse lower bound to the speed of light.
Oh, interesting.
It is the literal boundary line, the veil between our physical reality and the faster-than-light reality where the metafunctions actually live.
So a quantum wave function isn't just a blur of probabilities waiting for a scientist to collapse it by looking at it.
No.
It's an active dynamic connection to those hidden layers. And if that's true, quantum computation isn't about mimicking randomness at all.
Not at all.
It becomes a fundamentally creative act. You are literally arbitrating information from behind the quantum veil and pulling it into material existence.
It completely shifts the entire purpose of the machine. You aren't just processing constructive logic, you are interfacing with the very engine that creates physical reality.
That's wild. Let's move to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, though.
Okay.
Because we are taught that you can never accurately measure both the position and the momentum of a particle at the same time. The more you know about one, the less you know about the other.
Classic Heisenberg.
Right. And it's often cited as the ultimate proof that the universe is fundamentally blurry at the bottom.
Well, Malik views this entirely differently. He uses Planck's constant here again as a boundary between layers.
Okay.
In his view, that uncertainty you measure isn't a fundamental flaw of nature, nor is it a flaw in our measuring equipment.
And what is it?
It is simply a measurement of the variability that a metafunction requires to maintain its own integrity as it crosses from the infinite layer into the physical layer.
Wait, can you unpack that a bit?
Sure. Think of a spinning top. It has a slight wobble to maintain its overall upright stability, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That variability looks like uncertainty to us, but as the speed of light in those hidden layers approaches infinity, that variability actually drops to zero. Space and time quanta are emergent. They're not absolute.
So the universe isn't blurry.
No.
The metafunction is just doing whatever complex maneuvering it needs to do to stay stable, which registers as a wobble to our limited instruments.
Exactly.
I'm tracking with that. But then the presentation gets into Euler's identity.
Yes, Euler.
The notes claim this famous equation, which combines five fundamental mathematical constants, is actually summarizing the process of materialization itself.
Malik essentially takes Euler's equation and reads it like a structural recipe for creating reality.
A recipe?
Yeah, the model maps the numbers 0 through 4 to physical phases of emergence.
Okay.
0 represents an initial state of pure absoluteness. That yields to 1, which establishes an initial identity.
Got it.
That yields to 2, which allows for differentiation. Then 3 represents initial stability in the physical layer, and 4 is the full, robust physical manifestation of the object.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Please do.
Because mapping numbers 0 through 4 to philosophical concepts like differentiation and manifestation, it sounds a lot like mathematical poetry.
I hear that.
And the notes go even further, claiming that the mathematical constant E literally translates to exponential experimentation in a physical sense.
Right.
How does that actually work mechanically? I mean, it feels like we might just be forcing numbers to fit a narrative here.
That is a very fair challenge, and honestly, it requires a deep look at what these constants actually do mathematically.
Okay.
From an impartial standpoint, what Malik is doing is looking at the function of constants that govern growth, rotation, and limits in calculus, and assigning them physical roles in this light matrix.
So looking at their actual mathematical behavior.
Yes. Take the constant E. In calculus, E is unique because its rate of growth is always exactly equal to its current value. Its derivative is itself.
Right.
It is the ultimate mathematical representation of a continuous self-referencing feedback loop.
Oh, I see. So because E constantly feeds back into itself mathematically, Mech interprets that as the light matrix constantly feeding back into itself, like experimenting and iterating,
yeah,
as it tries to materialize forms.
Exactly. It's a self-referential process of continuous experimentation. Mm-hmm. And then consider pi, which relates to rotation and cycle.
Pi is roughly 3.14.
Right. Notice that 3.14 falls right between Malik's assigned values for stability, which is 3, and full manifestation, which is 4.
Oh, wow.
He interprets pi as the dynamic cyclical force relating those two states, constantly refining stability into physical reality.
That's a huge claim.
It is. You can certainly debate how literal this mapping is, but within the logic of his framework, it's a rigorous attempt to show that these constants aren't just arbitrary math tricks.
They're functional.
They are the mathematical shadows cast by the light matrix as it projects reality.
Okay, when you explain as a continuous feedback loop mapping to biological or physical iteration, I can actually see the internal consistency there.
It makes a kind of sense, right?
It does. It is a massive conceptual leap, obviously, but it holds together structurally. But let's bring all this incredibly heavy theoretical physics back down to Earth.
Good idea.
Why should you, the listener, care about Euler's identity or the properties of infinite light? Like, how does this actually change the physical hardware sitting in a server rack right now?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it shifts the entire trajectory of the multi-billion dollar tech industry.
How so?
Current quantum computers require massive, resource-heavy logical structures to try and simulate large volumes of space-time. Why? because they are using that brute force probabilistic approach.
Because of Feynman.
Exactly. They are rolling billions of dice to guess what nature is doing. But under Malik's model, we can achieve what is called sublinear scaling.
Sublinear scaling. Explain the mechanics of that. How do we get more computing power out of a smaller machine?
Because space-time is an emergent property governed by specific metafunctions, you don't need to waste computing power simulating the empty space itself.
Oh, I see.
You only need to tap into and compute the underlying algorithm, the metafunction that generates the space.
You know, it's remarkably similar to how modern video games render massive open worlds.
Oh, how so?
Well, game developers used to have to manually program and store every single tree and blade of grass individually, which, you know, take up massive amounts of memory.
Right, right.
But now, they use procedural generation. They just write a single mathematical algorithm that tells the game how to grow a forest, and the computer generates it on the fly.
Yes.
You save a massive amount of hardware space by just computing the underlying logic.
That procedural generation analogy is exactly how sublinear scaling operates in Malik's theory. A much smaller device can tackle a vastly larger application area because it's computing the underlying metafunctional logic, not brute forcing the surface level statistics.
And the physical makeup of the computer has to change too, right? Because right now, tech companies are obsessed with building quantum computers using qubits.
Qubits, yes.
But qubits are essentially artificial creations. They force particles into unnatural states of superposition. And because they are artificial, they are incredibly fragile.
Very fragile.
A qubit is like a tightrope walker. If there's the slightest gust of wind or a tiny fluctuation in heat or ambient vibration, the qubit basically falls off the rope.
Right.
It loses its quantum state, which is a failure known as decoherence.
And preventing that decoherence requires extreme measures. You have to keep qubits in massive refrigeration units at near absolute zero, perfectly isolated from the environment.
Yeah.
And even with all that protection, the transcript notes that today's qubit computers are at best 95% accurate.
Which, I mean, that sounds decent if you're making a weather forecast. But for simulating a complex pharmaceutical drug at the molecular level, a 5% error rate compounds so fast that it ruins the whole calculation.
Complete.
Completely unacceptable.
But Malik's light-based model points out something crucial here. We don't need to build artificial, fragile qubits.
Yeah.
We already have structures in nature that possess inherent, robust quantum dynamics. Think about stable atoms, or molecular plant structures, or biological cells.
Wait, they organize themselves perfectly without needing to be frozen to absolute zero.
Exactly, because they are governed by those underlying metafunctions that ensure their natural order. An atom is fundamentally stable at room temperature.
Right.
Its quantum states aren't artificial tightrope walkers. They are the natural resting state of the system. The model argues that we can use these inherently stable room temperature atoms or cellular structures as the actual foundation for an entirely new genre of quantum hardware.
A room temperature quantum computer. No supercooling, no massive refrigeration units required.
And the functional mathematics of this model ensure that the underlying metafunction actively maintains its own integrity. That means decoherence basically becomes a non-issue. A computer built on this principle wouldn't accidentally lose its state when bumped. It would have vastly longer state lifetimes, virtually zero decoherence, and operate at 100% accuracy.
100%.
Because atoms and molecules operate stably in nature with 100% accuracy every single second of the day.
That's a staggering claim, really. I mean, it means abandoning the fragile, freezing, 95% accurate qubit that the industry has spent billions developing.
Yep.
And replacing it with a stable, room temperature, 100% accurate device that simply harnesses the natural intelligence of atoms.
It completely redefines what is possible in the field. It demands that we move away from trying to force nature to fit our statistical guesswork.
Right.
And instead learn to leverage the precise metafunctional logic that already builds the universe.
So what does this all mean? Let's take a moment to recap the incredible journey we've just been on today. We started with Feynman's vision of a probabilistic universe, a reality built on the foundational chaos of rolling dice, where we can only ever guess at what nature is doing.
And from there, we explored Malik's radical counterproposal, which is a universe built not on chaos, but on an underlying matrix of light.
Yeah.
We saw how light slowing down from an infinite speed translates pure presence, power, knowledge, and harmony into the physical mechanics of energy, time, space, and gravity.
We fundamentally redefined space itself. It's not an empty void, it's a granular arena. It's a highly programmed pixel grid where every point is dictated by an intelligent, creative meta function.
Which is huge.
And we saw how that paradigm shift logically alters the math of Schrodinger and Heisenberg, proving that the universe isn't blurry. It's just incredibly complex and actively maintaining its own stability.
Which ultimately brought us to the hardware revolution.
Right.
The blueprint for a sublinear, 100% accurate, room temperature quantum computer that works with nature's procedural logic rather than against it.
It is an immense amount of theory to process.
Yeah.
But there's one final provocative thought from the sources that really stuck with me.
Oh, what's that?
Malik points out that the quantum realm isn't just a layer of physics. It is the boundary line. It is the veil that separates the invisible potential of light from the visible reality of matter.
Right.
And he warns that right now, as a technological industry, we are falling into a trap. Mm-hmm. We are trying to use quantum computers just to run faster digital use cases, you know, like optimizing global supply chains, rendering graphics, or cracking passwords.
Yeah, we are treating the most profound mechanism in the universe like a giant super fast calculator.
Exactly. But if this model is true, quantum computation isn't about calculating. It is fundamentally creative.
Wow.
It is literally the act of pulling new information, new meta functions from behind that quantum veil and materializing them into physical reality.
That's a powerful way to frame it.
So I want to leave you with this to mull over today. If we succeed in building these light-based room temperature machines, are we just building better calculators? Or are we building machines capable of actually imagining and perhaps even manifesting completely new laws of physics? Because if the universe isn't just a murky casino of rolling dice, but a canvas of infinite light waiting to be expressed, then the only limit to what we can compute is what we are bold enough to ask it to create.